You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Close Up. This is Kelly Carter, and it's my first episode. I'm a Hollywood reporter for ESPN's The Undefeated, but I've been covering this space for a really long time. You know, doing this podcast is special to me because I wanted to go deep with film creators. I love hearing what makes people tick and what ultimately leads them to creation. And hey, what a time for this podcast to debut. It's Oscar nomination week, and this is actually one of my favorite weeks of the year, and here's why. The prognostication can now actually begin. This is kind of like Selection Sunday if you're a college basketball fan, except over here, there's a lot more glitter, a lot more glam, and it's a little less sweaty than the basketball court. Well, if you're an Oscar nominee, there's a little bit of sweat. So my guest today is actor Peter Dinklage. You guys probably know him best from Game of Thrones, but you should get to know, honestly, his best performance so far in his new film, Cyrano. I'm excited to let you guys in on that conversation, but here's how it's gonna go down every week on this podcast. I'm going to let you inside of my group chat. As Hollywood reporters, we say a lot of stuff and we know a lot of stuff. And I know that my phone has been blowing up since the nominees were announced, and I'm sure theirs are too. So today I'm bringing my friends into this conversation, Film Awards editor for Variety Magazine, Clayton Davis, and award-winning entertainment journalist, KJ Matthews. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
You know, last time we were all together in real life, we were on a shuttle bus in Atlanta heading to a studio to talk classic throwback films.
Yeah.
Exactly. But now the games have officially begun. Oscar nominations came out this week. So I want to start here. What were your biggest surprises? Clay, let's start with you on that one.
Overperformance of Power of the Dog getting 12 nominations. Lady Gaga, even though I predicted it, or was talking about it, rather, her missing Best Actress, and Latinos having a really good day.
Yeah, that's fair enough. KJ, what about yourself?
You know, I know no one's talking about this on Twitter, so, you know, if no one's talking about it on Twitter, nothing matters, right? But right. I was actually surprised that John Abernathal did not get nominated in the Best Supporting Actor category, for his performance in King Richard as the coach, Rick Macchi. I thought he did a phenomenal job. I thought there was a long shot, but I thought maybe, just maybe, he would be nominated.
That's interesting. You know, I don't know if I was necessarily surprised by anything, because I feel like I've trained myself to not be surprised about much, but the thing that I probably was most pleasantly surprised about was the diversity. I know we spend a lot of times talking about the actor categories and even the film categories too, but I also love seeing some of the diversity behind the scenes too, you know, in Best Song and also in executive producers. I thought that was important too, but let's talk about that because, you know, I remember Clay specifically last year, we were talking about the lack of Latinx representation. And the one thing that we kind of agreed on was, had West Side Story been in the mix, that we probably would be having a different conversation, which brings us to 2022. And we are having a different conversation. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we had a lot of Latinx films this year, you know, aside from West Side Story and obviously getting Ariana DeBose, who looks really good right now to win an Academy Award. She'll be the second Latina to ever win an acting Oscar, period. The first one was her co-star, Rita Moreno, who played Anita in the 1961 version. So if you play Anita, you win Oscars.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free.
But what I'm really interested in is just kind of, what does it look like going forward? We had a record number of people of color nominated last year. 9 out of the 20 acting slots were occupied by people of color. This year, not as much. I want to see the year that we're all hitting all cylinders everyone's winning, you know, because it's always like one step forward, a few steps back. We don't have a black woman nominated in director yet, you know, still waiting for that. There's a lot of firsts that we're still chasing.
Yeah. KJ, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I always try to ask myself, how will we gauge in Hollywood where we have really reached a peak level of diversity?
Yeah.
And every year for the last couple of years, we've been doing this Oscar So White. And then, of course, there wasn't enough diversity with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Mm. And I just don't know what it's going to take. I'm glad that we have, you know, some representation in the Best Actor category with Will Smith and Denzel Washington. And, of course, with Anjanue Ellis and in Best Supporting and Ariana. But it's still not enough yet. I want to get to a point in Hollywood where every single major category is represented by people of color, women of color, and we don't even have to talk about this anymore.
Yeah, you know, and I feel like the thing that was most disappointing to me is this year in particular, we didn't have a large field to choose from, specifically with that Best Actress category. So to me, and I think to you guys too, that means that the problem really starts well before we get to award season. We need for studios to greenlight things. We need for financiers to put the money into making films so that we have a broader base of things to choose from and to pick from. And I don't know what it's going to take for that to actually happen, but I do feel like there is some progress, because you look at someone like Gina Prince-Bythewood, who 20 years ago made her debut film, Love and Basketball, but it took her about 18 years to get caught up to the big leagues. With The Old Guard, which went on Netflix, it did very well. And now she finally got a big budget to make The Woman King, which is coming out in the fall. So maybe this time next year we get to talk about that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. You know, the thing is, too, even if we get all of that, Kelly, which is exactly what we need, you're so on point with all of those assessments. We still need all of the Academy members to be willing to watch this breadth of films, not just your friends' films, not just the films you're familiar with, not just the films that you're comfortable with, but films that you've never heard of. And getting them to watch all those films is another. Well, I mean,
that's very true.
Like KJ saying, you know, it's about all of us winning consistently, but you nailed it, Kelly. It's Oscars are always the scapegoat. The problem isn't Oscar. The problem is Hollywood. Mm. We can't get mad that the Academy didn't choose the one of two black women that were actually in the running this year. Like, I want a bench. I want a deep bench of choices.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, Clay, you said something that's so important, and I want to use a few seconds to have all of us kind of pop our collar a little bit, because we want to talk about campaigning to voters. This is the first season that all three of us are voters in major award shows in Hollywood. We are not voters. We're not voters in the Academy Awards, so don't be, you know, sending us really mean tweets. We had nothing to do with this bet of nominees.
Right.
But, you know, we vote in Critics' Choice and Golden Globes, and that feels kind of special. But we also are now on the receiving end of campaigning. Let's talk about that, because we know that these studios and companies spend upwards of $15 million hiring consultants to help campaign and get the job done. Clay, you and I were talking a little bit about this earlier this week. Let's try and break down, and KJ too, of course, let's try and break down what a campaign actually looks like. Like, what do you see from someone who really wants to win one of these awards?
I mean, besides, you know, tastemaker events, you know, having parties just to rub elbows, traveling to various festivals, and then comes like swag. So it becomes a lot of like, you know, what is cool? What do you get? You know, I remember the Roma pillow. I remember, this isn't unique just to film, TV. Like, I got a Wu-Tang record player like earlier this year. Like, they do send stuff out to get people to notice you and to think of that. But I think what we're trying to fix here, I think we need some campaign reform. Think of it like a presidential election.
Exactly.
You know, if it's about the movies, let it be about the movies, not, you know, what you got and where you got it or who you know.
Yeah. Let's dissect Will Smith, for example. Yeah. He's nominated for an Academy Award for excellent work in King Richard, being a
two Academy Awards, by the way.
And
two.
Right.
To account, because also as an executive producer, mm-hmm. let's put that out there too, because that also is important. This is the second year in a row that a black man behind the camera is being nominated in that specific category.
The most strongest, the most powerful, the most dangerous creature on this whole earth. It's a woman who know how to think.
So the thing is, Will Smith wanted this award, and he made it known that he wanted this nomination. We saw him doing more interviews than he has ever done over the course of his career. This man released a memoir, told you that Stockard Channing was his crush. Mm. I mean, he was putting everything out there, you know, to really let you know that he's a man of the people. He is that Bel-Air, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air spinoff that's coming out soon to Peacock. So he's really making himself accessible. What do you guys make of that? Do you think that there's something to how you campaign ultimately resulting in you getting that nomination and maybe even the win?
I think that used to be the case pre-Harvey Weinstein. I think that he changed things, and I think that the pandemic changed things. I don't know if you remember how there used to be the whisper campaign in Hollywood, and you probably remember this, Clayton, where people would whisper and put out kind of negative things about you, be rumors and innuendos to kind of like thwart your chances of actually being nominated. And that happened up until about the Weinstein thing. And then I think now that he's removed and now that we're in a pandemic and things are so virtual and different, things are changing. But mark my word, campaigning is still out there. And even though people are saying, we don't think it's ethical, we think you should just let the work speak for itself. If you're a great actor or you have a great picture, it should just speak for itself. The reality is Hollywood has always been in bed with Hollywood. There's always been campaigning, whether it's publicly or it's not public. You know, people will always campaign to get their project awards.
Yeah. To kind of tie a nice tidy bow on the campaign conversation, I will say that for me, I think hands down the best campaign was 20 years ago, and it was Halle Berry in Monsters Ball. Mm. And that campaign was, it's been 74 years. This has never happened. A black woman has never won Best Actress at the awards. Let's make history. And history, of course, was made 20 years ago. Not only Halle Berry winning that award, and also let's say that another black actress has not won that award since then, but Denzel Washington won an Oscar that year, and Sidney Poitier, the late, great Sidney Poitier, won an honorary award. I'm going to ask you guys to do the most difficult thing that you can possibly do during Oscar nominations week, but I'm going to do it, dang it, anyway. Predictions for Best Actor, Actress, and Best Picture. KJ, let's start with you on that.
Okay, so Best Actor, it's Will Smith's night.
Okay.
It's Will Smith for King Richard. When it comes to the Best Actress, I think it could be Nicole Kidman or a toss-up between Kristen Stewart for Spencer. I really, really do. But I'm leaning towards Nicole Kidman, although if I had my fan favorite, I would say it would be Kristen Stewart for Spencer.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so Best Picture. You know, I hate to say this because I know they're the fan favorite and everybody's been saying they've got the most nominations, but I really do believe it's going to be The Power of the Dog. But I would love it to be King Richard. But I do think that it's going to be The Power of the Dog. In fact, I think they might have a sweep this particular award season when it comes to the Oscars, in my opinion.
Okay. Okay, we're going to remember that. Clayton, how about yourself?
Will Smith is pretty easy to call in Best Actor. Actually, I do predictions one week after Oscars happen for the very next year. And I had Will Smith last year. So this is a 12-month ordeal of getting to this moment. I feel good about him.
And I can confirm that because you put it on your Instagram. I remember.
Document those bragging rights. With actress, though, that's really wide open.
Okay.
I honestly think it could be Kristen Stewart or Kidman. I think Jessica Chastain could pull it off in the end, too. Like, I think that's definitely on the table. She hasn't won before.
No, she hasn't.
This is her third nomination. You know, Coleman, Kidman, they've won. Stewart's the first nom. You know, we could see how this works out.
Yeah.
And then picture, my gut is saying Power of the Dog, but I will say, and people don't know this, preferential ballot, the way that you vote for Best Picture, you rank the movies. So it's not about what's the most loved. It's about what's the most liked.
Yeah.
And twos and threes come a long way. That's why I think Belfast and King Richard, dangerous to possibly do it.
Ooh, I like that. Well, for me, it's going to be Will Smith because, like I said, Will has been campaigning for this, but even long before his campaign began, I was talking with the director, Marcus Ronaldo Green, and he was telling me how Will took a post-it note for every scene, even the scenes that he wasn't in King Richard, and broke it down. And importantly, he told me this, and Anjanou Ellis told me this, that he showed up to every rehearsal and read-through, which an actor of his caliber and his stature, you guys know better than me, they don't show up for that kind of stuff. But he did it because he wanted to make sure every ounce of this film was delivered on, you know, the way that he saw that vision as executive producer. So I feel like you work so hard for it, buddy. You need to win that award.
Right.
And Best Actress, I think Nicole Kidman. And I would love to actually write in Macbeth as Best Picture, but since Macbeth did not get nominated, I feel like I'm going to go with West Side Story. Look, Steven Spielberg has been doing this for now 51 years. He is beloved in this industry. People love the original film. They love the remake. I say, why not?
Not bad.
But I had another one. But before I tell you the other one, I want to hear what you guys love that you didn't see get a nomination. It can be a film or it can be a person. Clayton?
My favorite film of the year was Come On, Come On with Joaquin Phoenix.
Let me ask you a question. Why does everything have to be like this kind of weird, eccentric thing that you do? I know, but why not just do something normal? Like everything in your real life.
What's normal?
Okay, fine. Good point.
I'm always reluctant to say what my favorite film of the year is because typically 9 times out of 10, it doesn't get nominated for anything. So probably you don't want me to love your film as much as I do. But yeah, I was disappointed to see that go zero. And also Tessa Thompson in passing. She has my heart forever.
KJ, you're up.
Just one. Mahershala Ali for Swan Song.
And what about me? Waking up in this place waiting for you to pull a plug. Being told I'm not me. Because you're not me. You are not me!
Swan Song was done so well. Mahershala Ali just owned the screen with that. And just no recognition. It was very surprising to me.
Yeah. So for me, I said I love Macbeth. I also really love Zola. When I first saw it at Sundance, I thought that was amazing. But, you know, I thought that Cyrano might have done a little bit better. You know, that's the film that's starring Peter Dinklage, who is my guest on this episode, and you'll hear from him later on in the show. But to explain to the listening audience, that film is based on a play, Cyrano de Bergerac, which is about a man who is a beautiful poet, but he has a big, ugly nose. He falls in love with the very beautiful Roxanne, who thinks that she can't love him back, or he thinks that she can't love him back. So he decides to write love letters from the very handsome Christian to Roxanne. In this film, of course, there is no big ugly nose, but it's Cyrano's size. That's the thing that makes him feel a little bit insecure and unworthy of Roxanne's love. And Peter Dinklage, of course, is 4.5 feet tall. And to boot, it's a musical, which is my all-time favorite. I love a good musical. So Peter Dinklage did not get the nomination, even though a lot of people thought that maybe this might have been his year to get it. There are all kinds of reasons why people actually don't get nominated. I think the reason why this year is because it was such a crowded field. How about you two? What did you guys think about his work in Cyrano?
I mean, I think it's the best work he's done in film yet in his career. That already has a lot of great performances. I think there were two things that were probably not in his favor. One, a late release, because the movie's still like kind of being released right now. And two, and you touch on it, musicals walk in the door with their back against the wall. People will say, I don't like musicals and I don't like horror films. And it's really hard to convert those people. Mm-hmm. And we already had two other musicals in the conversation, West Side Story and Tick, Tick, Boom. So I think that was just, you know, not working out for him. Next time,
Peter, hang in there. You know, Peter made news, of course, recently criticizing the new Snow White reboot. Full disclosure, Disney is ABC's parent company. But Peter Dinklage, you know, said that it was a backward story about seven dwarves living in a cave. Actually, he makes the same point In my conversation with him, Disney, of course, has responded by saying to avoid reinforcing stereotypes from the original animated film, we are taking a different approach with these seven characters and have been consulting with members of the dwarfism community. Now, we've seen Hollywood portray stereotypes of all kinds for a really long time, and we've seen some directors, you know, try to do their best, even if they're not part of the community that they're actually, you know, documenting in film, bring on culturally appropriate consultants. What can studios or directors do to portray people correctly?
When studios are greenlighting things, or there are writers that are writing things, or directors that are directing things, make sure you have everyone in the room from that part of the community of the story in which you are telling. It's always been pretty simple. Just make sure the table has a lot of different people in it. It's just really going above and beyond to make sure that you're representing accurately what you're, you know, the story that you're telling.
Yeah.
And everyone needs to do that. And studio executives are the ones that, you know, disobey this law the most. And that's why they keep stepping into it.
I think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, we need to have more people of color in the, you know, in all of these slots. So it would take care of things. But I think that you're right, Clay. We do need more representation there. But I think that people shouldn't be writing, producing, directing anything about communities they don't know about unless they have people of those communities on board with that project. That's just the bottom line.
I love that. And I love both of you guys.
I love you.
Thank you.
Thank you both to KJ Matthews and Clayton Davis for being here, which is my very first episode.
Congratulations, you superstar.
Congratulations. Go Kelly. So proud of you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. We're going to take a quick break, but my conversation with Peter Dinklage comes on the other side.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
So Peter Dinklage always wanted to be an actor ever since he was growing up in his native New Jersey. He and his brother used to put on rock music puppet shows that was soundtracked by The Who. But you know, it took a long time for him to actually make a breakthrough in Hollywood, in part because he wanted to be very intentional about the roles that he chose and not rely on these stereotypical parts that normally are saved for actors his size. So I've always loved his work, but I really found myself marveling at what he turned in Game of Thrones. I know I'm not the only person in the Game of Thrones hive. You know, he obviously was Tyrion Lannister, who was a sarcastic, funny, clever, witty member of the Lannister family. And his size informed the character, but it didn't overwhelm it. And I really love that part of it. And that also lends itself quite naturally into the work that we're talking about right now, Cyrano. That's his new film. But long before Cyrano, and certainly long before Game of Thrones, Peter Dinklage's debut on the big screen was Living in Oblivion, a 1995 low-budget indie film about the process of making a low-budget indie film. Peter, I would love to have you take me back to 1995. I want to remind people that are listening that that's when you first started out. What were your expectations of your career in Hollywood at that time?
I started in 1995, huh? I had dreams of Hollywood since 1969, but 1995. Yeah. Well, I had no idea what I was doing, Kelly. I was young and silly, and we were living in a very different time back in the 90s. Films and the ability to see all of them and the amount of films being made was so different than what it is today. You know, I moved to New York. I went to school up in Vermont, and I moved straight down into New York City just to do theater, really, and work with my friends and put on plays, and movie people did movies. I didn't really ever consider myself. I loved movies. I lived and breathed going to the movies, but it never was really on my radar, truly. And then I got this call and went in and read for Living in Oblivion, and the director gave it to me, and I got lucky because it was a really funny movie and with great, great actors.
Why does my character have to be a dwarf?
It doesn't have to be a dwarf.
Then why is he? Is that the only way you can make this a dream? Put a dwarf in it?
No, Tito.
Have you ever had a dream with a dwarf in it? Do you know anyone who's had a dream with a dwarf in it? No!
It allowed me to sort of to express what I've always wanted to express, my outrage in terms of movies and what they do with how they utilize people my size and sort of make them dream characters. And I was just, and but while having great humor to it as well. So it was definitely a really great start. And then the slog continued, and it, you know, it's whose work was few and far between, but I stuck it out and worked hard.
One thing that feels so connective to your story that I'm so accustomed to talking with other actors about is otherness and the refusal in a lot of cases to raise your hands to do work that you feel plays into a stereotype, whether that be an accent that in the past has been used to poke fun of people or a refusal to portray like a one-dimensional character, like a certain type of Black man. And I've read that's been a line in the sand for you. The question that I normally ask is, how challenging was that for you to say no, especially starting out in your career? Because I imagine that you were getting some of those offers coming your way.
Right. I mean, if we can't blast stereotypes in entertainment, where can we blast them? You know what I mean? What we are given in movies and just as performers, we're given a golden ticket to do anything we want in storytelling with characters, to tell any story. And if we continue just because something makes money, I mean, it is a business, to perpetuate stereotypes based on what is successful or what we're, you know, that's up to us to change it. It's on me to not go in as a spokesperson, but just to make choices that change the game. I mean, for a century now, we've been inundated with romantic love stories have been the domain of beautiful white people. Tall, handsome men, beautiful women. And is that the only love story? You know, that's the stereotype that we've perpetuated for 100 years now. And it just makes me sad because so many love stories aren't being told. The world is starting to recognize that now. Many people have always recognized that, but it's what we put out there. I just love what I do for a living, and I never want to tarnish it with something I'm uncomfortable with or feel exploited about. I'm not politically correct. I just know what doesn't feel right. Mm. I don't want to lose my sense of humor about things. I own who I am, but that's me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I can make fun of myself. We all can. But as soon as you start to be made fun of, that's the difference.
Yeah.
You're not.
And I think that there's some kind of fun poetic justice in that I have to imagine that you've had to think about this over the years, because I think that a lot of people identify your amazing breakthrough moment was in 2003 in Elf. You know, there's that really great scene with Will Ferrell. And I wonder.
Another one, sort of like a Living Oblivion moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know you had elves working here.
Boy, you're hilarious, my friend.
Does Santa know that you left the workshop?
You know, we're all laughing our heads off.
Did you have to borrow a reindeer to get down here?
Buddy, go back to the basement.
Hey, Jackweed, I get more action in a week than you've had your entire life. I've got houses in LA, Paris, and Vail.
I wondered if that felt validating to you on some level, because even though maybe you weren't trying to make a statement with that role, I think you made a statement with that role and people paid attention to it.
Right. And with humor, which I think really reaches everybody. I think, it was great because, a lot of young people see that movie. Children come up to me on the street. They remember that film and they love it. And it's so beautiful and sweet. And it leaves an impression with them, you know, about all of that stuff that we were talking about. And, you know, as much as I don't set out to do that, if it's a residual of what I've done, then fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. So Peter, please allow me to geek out for a moment if I can. In the summer of 2020, I had time. We all had time. We found ourselves with all this time on our hands. And I was one of those fools, and yes, I'm using the word fools, who had not seen not one frame of Game of Thrones. And I marathoned it. And
there's a lot of you out
there. Not one frame. And I marathoned it and I live tweeted the entire series in 1 week. I watched all seasons in 1 week.
Wow.
Yes, I needed lots of therapy while watching it.
Wow.
But you know, early on, without knowing what would happen with your character, I was very protective of him. He was easily one of my favorites. And I kept going, nothing better happened to my boy Dinklage. What has that role done for your career? Because I imagine a lot of people felt that way about that character. I mean, it was just so transformative for you, I think.
Yeah, well, thanks for watching it. I hope your eyes are not still aching from all that watching. I've done that a few times with some shows when I had some time in my hands, and the pandemic definitely gave us some time to watch stuff. So thank you. I still get a lot of people on the street going, I never watched that show. They like to make a statement to me, like they're proud of it or something. Right. They're like, you were in Game of Thrones. Yes. I never watched it. Okay. People love doing that on the street. It's very strange. But I love that character. That was, not only was it a great show, it was like 10 years of my life. So anybody who does a long running TV show will tell you it's just interwoven. Life and work are one and the same because you're working with familiar people for so long. But the character was so smart and so funny. He was definitely he provided a certain amount of relief from all the ongoings and a certain commentary upon the ongoings that everybody sort of can relate to in a humorous way.
I'm friends with your mother. I'm here to help. Don't eat the help.
If you have a humorous character, he's often just that. He or she is just that role. But the writers, David Benioff and Dan Weiss, they made him so complicated on top of all that. He wasn't just the comic sidekick. He was a really complicated character. And I loved the opportunity to explore his changes, because the way he started from season one was not who he was at the end.
Yeah. Do you think that the success of that series and the success of that role in particular made this town see you in a different way?
Well, hopefully. I mean, it definitely made people see me, and I can't do it any other way than the way I do it. So maybe they got something out of it. Hopefully a humanity that perhaps wasn't always the case, especially in the fantasy genre, you know, where dwarves, people, they're not real. They're like more like creatures than human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that prejudice going into the show before they told me about the character. But that prejudice of being creature-like and being mystical or whatever it is exists in a lot of fiction. And I mean, thank you, Snow White. You know, I find it interesting that they're very, and I mean, all due respect to everybody involved, but they're very proud of the latest Snow White being a Latino actress, and she's incredible. She's wonderful, and I'm sure, but it's Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. I'm very curious to see what they're going to do there.
Mm.
So we just have to understand all aspects of everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Cyrano is amazing. You know, I first saw it months ago. And when I saw it, I said yes to so many things. I want to start with your performance. What was it about this story that really called to you and spoke to you as an actor?
His complexity. It was never on my radar until Erica Schmidt had this great adaptation for it. She got rid of the nose and added songs.
Roxanne, what am I supposed to say? Words are only glass on a string.
I just thought that was a really smart way in to the piece that had never been done before. Because what is Cyrano known mainly for is nose. Mm-hmm. So what are you left with when you take it away? You're left with the human experience that everybody goes through. And she got rid of like the theatricality of that fake nose, which often was the case, you know. It's a handsome actor and a fake nose. What is he griping about, you know? Yeah. He doesn't have a hard life. How come he feels unworthy of love? I mean, I understood the poetry of it and the beautiful writing, but just on a personal level, I never connected to it until Erica stripped it down a bit to its bare essentials.
Speaking of Erica Schmidt, she's not only your collaborator in the film as a screenwriter, but she's your wife too. Tell us what it was like working with your partner and who approached whom first on doing this particular project.
It's been great. We've worked on a number of theater pieces in the past before. It's great to have that familiarity, that way you understand the way each other works. And obviously you have that shorthand and communication. You don't have to really small talk. You can just get straight to the work. And there's a lot of that on Cyrano. Joe Wright and Haley Bennett are partners. Aaron and Bryce Desner, they're our composers, our twin brothers. Matt Berninger and Corinne Besser, the lyricists, are partners. So it was a real family affair on this one. Mm-hmm.
So was this her saying, honey, let's do this? Or you saying, honey, let's do this?
Oh, I beg for the part. She didn't write it with me in mind, truly. But when she, when I witnessed the pieces coming together, I really started to fall in love with the part that she created. And I sort of begged, I really on bended knee. I was like, can I just make an attempt to play this role? And then you can be honest with me. I lobbied for the part because we had done readings in our home with the composers and other actors. And I was just an actor in the room there to read a part. Truly, that's what you do with a lot of films and theater. You get friends of yours in somebody's house and you read through the script with no intention of playing the roles, just to hear it. It's just for your friend, the writer, to hear it out loud if it's working. And that's what I did with this and continued to do with it until she cast me.
I'm glad that worked out for you.
Yeah.
You know, you touched on this, I think, a little bit earlier in our conversation. But the other thing that I really loved about this film was the diversity, and in particular, the diversity without explanation in this film. And that feels very important and like something that we have to acknowledge. What was the conversation like on set with you and the other actors? Did you guys discuss that while filming, or was this just maybe even a way to communicate to this industry, this is what we should expect out of work like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie and it's also a musical. So it's a fantasia on real life. Someone my size couldn't be in the military in real life. Mm-hmm. My size, I'm 52 years old. So that's a fantasy already right there. Mm-hmm. So in movies, you should feel free to do anything you want, especially with casting. And if you are just limited to this small box, then like we spoke about with the pretty romantic leads, and you're just limiting the possibilities. And talent comes first. And Kelvin, for example, I mean, he's one of the most brilliant young actors, and my God, he can sing.
If I close my eyes, maybe I'll see you there one more time.
I saw that movie Waves he did.
Yeah.
a few years ago, and I could not shake that movie and his performance in that movie. So when he was cast in this film, I was just absolutely thrilled. And it's interesting because what Eric had done with that character, Christian is often played as adult, not as an adult, as adult, D-O-L-T, an idiot and unintelligent. And I think that's a misrepresentation of that character. I think he's just open-hearted. And I think that can be misconstrued as naive, which then would mean not intelligent. But Christian is the only one who has the intelligence to not put himself in front of love. Mm. When he finds out that Cyrano's in love with Roxanne, he steps away from it. That's not emotional intelligence. I don't know what is. No, it's a brilliantly complicated role, and what Kelvin did with it is amazing.
Yeah, no, he's really great in this. And also, like you said, the casting is brilliant because Kelvin Harrison Jr., of course, is a Black actor, and normally Christian is portrayed by a white actor. So, you know, kudos for that casting.
Yeah, I mean, that's a no-brainer for me. You just cast the most talented people. It doesn't matter how tall, how short, what race, my God. It's not what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously within reason, if it's like a historical piece, you know, you have to obviously adhere to the certain realities of life, but with a fiction piece, with a musical, especially, the world's your oyster in terms of casting and the stories you tell.
Mm. Yeah. Before I let you go, what does it take for you to say yes at this point in your career? What types of things excite you?
Boy, that's a really good question. You know, I'm excited by I have this production company now for a few years, and I'm excited about being in on the ground floor and developing material, not griping as an actor about not getting to be acting movies I want, but creating them with great writers and great directors. And it's a common thing for when the actors get older, they step behind the camera and want to have more creative control over things. Not waiting for the phone to ring, but calling people and saying, hey, you want to be in this movie? That's what's exciting.
Mm. I love all of that. Peter Dinklage, thank you so much for doing this today. This was an absolute treat.
Thank you so much.
Man, I love when actors go behind the camera. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what Peter's production company does and what kind of projects they come out with. Guys, that was a wrap on my first show. I'm so excited. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please follow us wherever you get your podcasts and rate us, because that really goes a long way. Talk soon. Next week on Close Up, we talk with someone who's always been behind the camera, who is up for his 11th Oscar nomination, Steven Spielberg. And in his new film, he goes where he's never gone before.
I always said that I've never done a musical, I've never done a Western. And I really have much more interest in musical idiom than I do in Westerns.
How he finally brought his West Side Story dreams to life, and what Rachel Zegler learned from being on set with him.
I knew that I wanted to work with you when I left every single audition saying, if that's it, that's fine. I've had this and that's great.
We talk West Side Story and all things Spielberg. That's next time on Close Up. Close Up is a production of ABC Audio, produced by Vika Aronson, Carrie Ann Thomas, and David Toledo, with help from Matt Wolf, Josh Cohan, Brenda Salinas Baker, Ariel Chester, Mary Pat Thompson, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia Dashishku. Lakia Brown is our senior producer, and Liz Alessi is our executive producer.